Wow, that was just overwhelming with your response. Let me try one more time. How are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Yo, can we give it up for this amazing worship crew and everyone that has put on today and this weekend? Can we give it up for them? Oh, my goodness, man. Okay, well, let me introduce myself. Since I'm a little strange to these parts, my name is Alonzo, and my friends, they call me Zoe, so y'all can call me Zoe, and I'm from, I live in Toronto right now, but I live in, I'm originally from Alberta, I'm from Calgary. Is anybody here from Alberta at all, or lived in Alberta? One dude in the back. All right, that's great, that's a good start to connect with the crowd. I'm Alberta, originally born and raised in Calgary, and that's where my bae and I started our own company. My bae and I, we are entrepreneurs. Do you know what I mean when I say bae? Is that, shake your head if I, okay, I just want to make sure that I'm speaking the right language. Maybe it's just because it's 9:30 at night that bae just goes over your head, my boo. Her and I, we're entrepreneurs. We started this men's grooming brand, and we were doing certain things, and we, that's kind of my background, and from there, my wife and I, we moved to Oxford, England, and we went there for 3 years, and that's where I was studying just recently. I just moved from Oxford, England to Toronto, and in Oxford, England, I went to this little second-rate university called Oxford University. Perhaps you've heard of it. And study this thing called theology. Raise your hand if you know what theology means. It's okay. This is the study of God. It's kind of a broad topic to be learning about. So I did that, and now I live in Toronto. Do you guys visit Toronto regularly? Yeah, most people. It is crazy there. There's all, you know what, I'm not going to even get off on that tangent, but Toronto's awesome, except for traffic and all sorts of different things, and finally, it's been so nice to be here and see sunshine. I feel like I have not seen sunshine in such a long time, so it is an honor and a pleasure to be here with you guys. You know, I was just recently actually in Atlanta, and I was talking with my friends, and they were recently speaking. They worked for the same organization as me, RZIM. And we go and we speak in all sorts of audiences that don't believe in God. They think it's ridiculous, it's intellectual suicide to believe in God. They think it's just naive superstition. So we go and speak in those sorts of places. And a couple of the guys that I work with, they were recently speaking at Amazon and Facebook. You guys have heard of those places, yeah? And they were out speaking there, and they were like, Zoe, man, we know that you like to go and speak to young people, but wouldn't you like to rock up and speak at Facebook and Amazon? And I was like, nah, fam, I do not want to go there. I want to be exactly where I am right here talking to all of you. Absolutely. So I told my homeboy, I was like, you know what? These people are the very next generation of leaders, of politicians, of teachers, of deputies. And moms, the innovators of industry, you guys are going to invent things that we old people can't even think of yet. You guys are going to change the world. I want to be with you people who are going to own Amazon and Google and other places. And I'd rather put in my time, my work with y'all. Is that cool? So I'm very passionate about being here and very passionate about speaking with you guys. And I hope that tonight is going to be something that really helps you. Is that cool? I'm going to ask for a lot of feedback because I come from a loud church, and my home church in Calgary, we have 26 different nations, and many of those nations beside the Canadian, very loud nations. So I'm going to be a little bit loud. I hope that's okay. But I'm only here for a weekend. If you don't like it, then I'll be gone soon. And I'm going to do it anyways. And so I'm going to share with you guys something that has really helped me. And I speak to university students regularly, and I was just at the University of British Columbia, UBC, and I gave the same talk to these university students. So I hope this is okay that I'm going to give you the same talk as university students. Is that okay? Lawyers and engineers and all those sorts of things. Is that cool? You guys ready for it? Okay. We're going to look at, is faith or belief in God, is it irrational? Is it irrational? Irrational means like illogical or unreasonable. Is faith in God irrational? Perhaps you've thought about that. And so we're going to start it off, since we're talking about science, we're going to start off with a little bit of trivia and see if you guys will test your trivia skills. So recently, a friend of mine, his name is Sam Olbery, and he wrote this book. And in this book, he says, it turns out that there are many things we don't know quite as well as we think we do. So that is commonly assumed facts that are actually not true. You guys tracking with me? There are things out there that we think are true, but they turn out not to be true. So let's test your trivia skills. Number one, what is the tallest mountain in the world? What's the tallest mountain in the world? Go ahead, bro. Mount Everest. That's what I thought, but I was wrong. And so are you. So I'm going to, it's a good try though. Go ahead. Mount Fuji. That's a really great answer. But no, unfortunately, it's not Mount Fuji. Let me see in the back. Mauna Kea. You're the first guy in like over a dozen times that I've asked this question that has actually got it. It's actually Mount Mauna Kea. So let me explain Mount Mauna Kea to you. Give this guy a round of applause. Hopefully he wasn't Googling it. I'm going to trust y'all. But Mount Mauna Kea is nearly a mile taller than Mount Everest. It's because it starts at the bottom of the ocean and comes out. So it's the tallest mountain. It's not the highest mountain. Mount Everest is the highest mountain in the world. Okay, number two. How many moons does Earth have? How many moons does Earth have? That's what I thought, too. I thought it was one. I thought it was really obvious, but it's not. Go ahead, bro. No, it's not two, but we're getting close. Three, yes. So check this out. That was pretty easy to get to after I gave you that massive hint. There are also, so according to National Geographic in 2018, they said that there are all sorts of non-human created things that are floating around Earth that technically count as moons. So there are a whole bunch of these little things, and there are three that technically we can say are moons, even though one is the most obvious one that you and I can see. Number three, and last one. How many nostrils do human beings have? How many nostrils do human beings have? Two. That's what I thought again. Four. Yes, that's right. Okay, so check this out. Were you going to guess four? Yeah, okay, I thought so. Four. So there are actually two external nostrils, which you and I can see, and there are two internal ones. They call them koinonia, and they're on the inside, and they technically count as nostrils by themselves. So you actually have four. Likewise, so here's the transition. Likewise, it is often talked about that faith or belief in God is irrational, like believing in Santa Claus or something like that. But that's actually not true. I'm so sorry if you believe in Santa Claus. But that's actually not true. And there are very good reasons and evidences to believe that God actually exists and that faith in him is actually rational. Is that making sense? Is everyone tracking with me so far? Okay. And so, again, like I just gave this stuff to all sorts of different universities. And we've been at University of Saskatchewan this year, and or actually at the end of last year. And we were at McGill University in Montreal and University of Toronto and UBC, like I just mentioned. And this is probably one of the most common objections to your faith and mine that will arise at school or online or at university. So it's really important to really think this thing through so that you're well prepared for the future. Or maybe you're sitting here and you're like, Zoe, man, I'm not even convinced that there is a God. And so I'm going to do my very best in the 20 minutes that I have to try and convince you that there is actually a God, or that there's at least enough evidence out there to persuade you to say that this is actually a reasonable thing to believe in. Is that cool? Excellent. So if you like roadmaps, then I'm going to give you a roadmap for where we're going to be talking. I only got 3 points for you guys today, even though there are sub-points to it, but it's actually more than three. But I'm only going to say 3 points for you guys today. And all three is this. Number one is this. What do Christians mean by belief in God or faith in God. Number two is the nature of explanation. And then number three, I'm going to give you the evidence and reasons that I look at for the existence of God. So that's kind of our roadmap. So number one, what do Christians mean by belief in God or faith in God? This is critical for you to hear. This is critical for you to hear. Faith in Christianity does not mean blind faith. Faith in Christianity does not mean a leap in the dark. Faith in the New Testament is far better translated to mean trust. And it is a trust that is based on evidence. It's a trust that's based on evidence. And this makes a ton of sense when you start thinking about it. So take, for instance, again, my boo, my bae. Her name is Khadija. She is half East African from Tanzania, and she is half Punjabi. So she is the prettiest thing you have ever seen. If God made anything prettier than her, he kept it for himself. She is my baby, and I love her, and I think she's awesome. Anyways, that's my shameless plug. And so think about it in terms of, like, marriage, like with my wife, Khadija. So over a course of time, I've come to the conclusion that I can trust her, or I can have faith in her. Does that make sense? It's like a Kim Kardashian, Kanye West kind of thing. I can grow to trust the other person. So let me ask you guys a question. How do you prove that someone is trustworthy? That you can have faith in them? And when you think about the, I'm going to answer for you. Sorry, it was rhetorical. I should have made that clearer. That's my bad, homie. So the way that you can do this is you have to look at, what do we mean by prove? How do we prove that something is trustworthy, that you can have faith in it? Because many times when you're at university or wherever you go in life, when people say, oh man, like, can you prove the existence of God? What they really mean is this. They are looking for an absolute certainty. They're looking for an absolute certainty. So here's an example of an absolute certainty. 2 + 2 = 3. Close. it's 4. Yeah. 2 + 2 = 4. That's a mathematical certainty. And this is really important as well. Proof. Proof in this sense is actually very rare. And it is limited to only certain fields of thought, like the theoretical realm of mathematics. So how do we rationally conclude that we can have trust or faith in someone, like my wife? And the intuitive or obvious answer is evidence. I need to look at evidence and use clear reason to come to the conclusion that she's actually trustworthy. So think about it like this. I can talk to the people that know my wife, and I can get all of their opinions together, and I can say, well, is she a trustworthy person based on all of their testimonies? Or I could look at the evidence of all of the things that she's done over the past number of years. Is that something that a trustworthy person would do? And then lastly, and probably most significant for me, was my bae's public declaration of love on our wedding day. And I can look at all of these sorts of evidences, and I can reason my way rationally to come to the conclusion that she is somebody that I can have faith in. And I can do this rationally. This is the rational process of coming to trust anything. And it's the same process when we're looking at God. How many of you guys watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine? Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Come on, somebody. That's my favorite show right now. That's my jam. And so, like, what is Jake Peralta and Amy Santiago and all of those? What do they do when they're... So what do they do, first of all? Scream it out. Detectives. Thank you. So they are detectives, and so they would go to a crime scene. And at this crime scene, they don't have absolute proof that some person did this particular crime. So what do? What they do is they look at all of the evidence that's there. Maybe there's like a murder weapon, or maybe there's a blood splatter, or Maybe there was a witness that heard something or seen something. And they take all of that evidence and they say, what is the best explanation for everything that we see here? And that's the same way, that's the same process as when we're thinking about God. We're going to look at the evidence, and based on that evidence, we can place our trust there. Does that make sense so far? There's this university professor named John Lennox. He's a mathematician. He says this. He says, faith is not a leap in the dark. It's the exact opposite. It's a commitment based on evidence. It is irrational to reduce all faith to blind faith and then submit it to ridicule. That provides a very anti-intellectual, inconvenient way of avoiding intelligent discussion. So point number two is this. Okay, that's the process of coming to trust something rationally. But then there's another really important component to this discussion, which is the nature of explanation. The nature of explanation. So what does this mean? What we find here is an enormous misconception about God and about science. And it's this, that science and faith compete as an explanation for reality. But that competition is unnecessary. There is no competition for an explanation of reality between God and science. So here's a helpful way of thinking about it, and it's about hows and whys, or mechanism and agency. That's what they say in the literature. But you can think about it as hows and whys. So modern science has offered us incredible things, yeah? Medicine, Netflix, all sorts of awesome stuff, right? Science, modern science, is brilliant at telling us how things work. The how part is the focus of science. How does something work? But it's really limited to this region of how things work. Because science can never tell us why certain things are the way that they are in our universe. So we don't actually have to choose in between. We don't have to choose either God or science. In fact, we should have God and science. So let me give you a real quick example. Raise your hand if someone in your family drives a Ford truck. Okay, great. There's like 3/4 of us. So imagine you're looking at a Ford engine. And you look at this engine and you're like, I'm going to try and explain this engine. It would be crazy to think that you have to choose either between the law of internal combustion, which is the scientific analysis of the engine, between that and Henry Ford as an explanation for the existence of this engine. You don't have to choose between either of these. In fact, you probably want both of these explanations to explain the engine. Here's another one. So imagine you have an auntie, and we'll call her Auntie Priscilla, and because I have an auntie named Priscilla. And she bakes for you a cake. And let's say you have mad connections. And you, with your connections, you can get any sort of scientist you want. A nutritionist, a microbiologist, a chemist, a physicist, a mathematician, and so on. And you say, explain to me this cake. And they can do every complex analysis imaginable to this cake and tell you all sorts of crazy things like the nutritional content and the caloric intake and how Alonzo shouldn't be eating cake and stuff like that because he's got a little bit of love around his. I'm not going to go there. But they can tell all sorts of amazing things about this sort of thing, the molecular structure and so on. But what's the one thing that they cannot answer? They cannot answer the most basic of questions that any child could ask, which is, why was this cake made? Only the creator of this cake can explain why this cake was created. There's this Nobel Prize winner named Sir Peter Medawar. He writes this. the existence of a limit to science is clear by its inability to answer childlike elementary questions having to do with the first and last things. Questions such as, how did everything begin? And what are we here for? And what is the point of living? We need both God and science to answer the biggest questions of life, not just one or the other. Number three, the last point is this. And this is like, if you're taking notes, this is like, I'm giving you the tips and tricks, the stuff that I keep in my back pocket when I'm having a conversation with a friend of mine or even a stranger that doesn't believe in God. This is exactly the stuff that I speak to them about. And time again, people walk away saying, I've never thought about it that way. Or I didn't know that there was any evidence or any rational reasons to believe in God. So this is my very best stuff that I'm going to share with you guys. So check it out. If you're taking notes, this would be a great place to start if you haven't started already. Is there any evidence to support a rational belief in God? So here are some of the evidences. And let me just say this. This is contrary to popular belief. There are far more reasons and arguments and evidences for God's existence than people actually are aware of. And they come from all sorts of academic disciplines, everything from physics to philosophy to the highest levels of the academy. People are talking about their arguments for the existence of God. And in fact, some of the most brilliant women and men in our world are people that take their faith very seriously. I did some quick research for you guys, and between 1901 and 2000, over 60% of Nobel laureates were Christian. This is the very highest award you can get in science and in the fields that are surrounding science. Overall, Christians have won a total of 78.3% of all Nobel Prizes in peace, over 70% in chemistry, over 65% in physics, over 60% in medicine, over 50% in economics, and almost 50% in literature. So what are these reasons that convince these outstanding men and women that have won these awards? What are some of the reasons why they take their faith so seriously? And I'm going to give you guys four of them. So the existence of God best explains the origin of the universe, or the Big Bang, you may have heard that called, the fine-tuning of the universe. Number three, the life of Jesus of Nazareth. And finally, that God can be personally experience. And all of these things working together make this really compelling case that there is something serious here to think about. So number one, the origin of the universe. Now this is ridiculous. Like, if you want to read more into this, I can recommend some books for you. But it was up to the 19th century that scientists and philosophers that the universe always existed. And maybe you think that too, that the universe was just always there. But modern science and the advancement of technology has disproved that theory. The universe was not always there, but rather it came into existence. Perhaps one of the most famous atheist scientists in the world is this dude named Stephen Hawking. Raise your hand if you know who Stephen Hawking is. You heard of him. You may not know him personally. I don't either. But he says this. Almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning in the Big Bang. Now, this poses a huge problem for atheist scientists. So an atheist is somebody that doesn't believe in God. And the reason why that this poses such a big problem is that the Big Bang looks way too much like Genesis 1 through 3. It looks way too much in its suddenness, in its explosion. You know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and he said, let there be light, and boom, there was light. This is written thousands and thousands of years ago. And many atheists didn't want to believe this theory until the evidence was so overwhelming they had to, because it looked too much like the way the Bible said the universe started. Now, there's lots we could say there, but I'm going to move on. There's another huge problem that arises, and it's this. How can something come from nothing? And this is a serious problem if you don't believe in God. Because as Christians, we don't believe that it comes from nothing. We believe it comes from God. But the serious problem is this. For the entirety of human history, from everything that we can observe in science, the only thing that comes from nothing is nothing. For example, computers just can't spontaneously come into existence. And the universe is far more complex than a computer. Babies can't just come into existence. I'm going to let Pastor Louis tell you what the cause is for babies coming into existence. I assure you, they just don't randomly occur. Likewise, now you've got to follow me very closely here. Likewise, if everything that begins to exist has a cause, like babies and computers, and the universe began to exist, then logically it follows that the universe had a cause. Capital C. Number two, fine-tuning of the universe. Now, to give you a bit of a break from my voice, I got a video for you guys, and the Brody in the back is going to hook us up. But this is probably my favorite argument for God. Fine-tuning of the universe is incredible. And this video it's like a six-minute thing. And I urge you to listen to it and to take it seriously, because it is convinced one atheist or one person that doesn't believe in God after another that there is a fine tuner behind our finely tuned universe. DJ, you can play it.
From galaxies and stars, down to atoms and subatomic particles, the very structure of our universe is determined by these numbers. These are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. Scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers has been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value, a value that falls within an exceedingly narrow, life-permitting range. If any one of these numbers were altered by even a hair's breadth, no physical, interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. Consider gravity, for example. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant. If this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. To understand how exceedingly narrow this life-permitting range is, imagine a dial divided into 10 to the 60th increments. To get a handle on how many tiny points on the dial this is, compare it to the number of cells in your body, or the number of seconds that have ticked by since time began. If the gravitational constant had been out of tune by just one of these infinitesimally small increments, the universe would either have expanded and thinned out so rapidly that no stars could form and life couldn't exist, or it would have collapsed back on itself with the same result: no stars, no planets, and no life. Or consider the expansion rate of the universe. This is driven by the cosmological constant. A change in its value by a mere 1 part in 10 to the 120th parts would cause the universe to expand too rapidly or too slowly. In either case, the universe would, again, be life prohibiting. Or another example of fine-tuning. If the mass and energy of the early universe were not evenly distributed to an incomprehensible precision of 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, the universe would be hostile to life of any kind. The fact is, our universe permits physical, interactive life only because these, and many other numbers, have been independently and exquisitely balanced on a razor's edge. Wherever physicists look, they see examples of fine-tuning. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features that the universe has, he's hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. What is the best explanation for this astounding phenomenon? There are three live options. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Which of these options is the most plausible? According to this alternative, the universe must be life-permitting. The precise values of these constants and quantities could not be otherwise. But is this plausible? Is a life-prohibiting universe impossible? Far from it. It's not only possible, it's far more likely than a life-permitting universe. The constants and quantities are not determined by the laws of nature. There's no reason or evidence to suggest that fine-tuning is necessary. How about chance? Did we just get really, 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 really lucky? No. The probabilities involved are so ridiculously remote as to put the fine-tuning well beyond the reach of chance. So, in an effort to keep this option alive, some have gone beyond empirical science and opted for a more speculative approach, known as the multiverse. They imagine a universe generator that cranks out such a vast number of universes that odds are life-permitting universes will eventually pop out. However, there's no scientific evidence for the existence of this multiverse. It cannot be detected, observed, measured, or proved. And the universe generator itself would require an enormous amount of fine-tuning. Furthermore, small patches of order are far more probable than big ones. So the most probable observable universe would be a small one, inhabited by a single, simple observer. But what we actually observe is the very thing that we should least expect, a vast, spectacularly complex, highly ordered universe, inhabited by billions of other observers. So even if the multiverse existed, which is a moot point, it wouldn't do anything to explain the fine-tuning. Given the implausibility of physical necessity or chance, the best explanation for why the universe is fine-tuned for life may very well be it was designed that way. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect monkeyed with physics and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. There is, for me, powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge.
Right. It's dope, right? I mean, sick. So if the universe had a cause, and if you're curious about that link, I can send it to you. So just holler at your boy if you would like it. If the universe had a cause that is outside of itself, and the universe seems to be finely tuned to just the right amount so that you and me can be here, then this is a huge amount of evidence that we need to take seriously, and that seems to suggest that God does actually exist. Number three is the life of Jesus of Nazareth. The life of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, he is literally the most extraordinary person in history. Absolutely incredible. In 2013, Time magazine did this whole big thing with this whole panel of scholars, both Christians and non-Christians, and they're looking at hey, who has made the biggest imprint in history out of anyone? And this conclusion, the conclusion that was wildly unexpected, was that Jesus of Nazareth has made the biggest footprint in all of history. And there's tons of evidence to support this. And we're going to get into it tomorrow with the Why Trust the Bible. But if you're taking notes, a couple of pieces of things that there's tons of evidence to support is that he literally existed in heaven, that he claimed to be the Son of God, that we still possess accurate, credible accounts of his teachings and his miraculous actions. And most importantly, that he died on the cross for the world and rose from the grave 3 days later. So time is fleeting, and I'm just going to leave with you with these two thoughts before we get into our very last point, and it's this. If you're sitting here and really struggling with your faith in God, first of all, you're not alone in that. There are lots of really good people out there that seem to be struggling, and what I've found with talking with these people is when they take it really seriously and honestly, they can think deeply about these things and are often surprised at the vast amount of evidence and good reasons for why there is a God in existence. If you're one of those persons as well, and perhaps you're a little bit more hostile towards belief in God, and you say, no, I don't think there is still, then my challenge to you, my gentle challenge to you is this, is that any honest and rational person that doesn't believe in God has to find a rational account for all of the data that we see, especially the resurrection of Jesus. Because if Jesus rose from the grave, you got to hear me now. If Jesus rose from the grave, then that changes everything for you and for me. The second thing I want to say to you is this. For me and for many other people that I know, it was the study of Jesus and the Gospels, which are the biographies of Jesus. There's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It was the study of Jesus and the Bible that was the turning point for me in my faith. And you can do this at home. Like anyone can do this. If you want to take it seriously, you can do it even tonight. The fine-tuning argument and the origin of the universe and all of these things are really intellectually cool to look at and think about. But it's because of Jesus that I feel, and you've got to hear me now, it's because of Jesus that I feel like I matter in this huge universe. That I'm loved. And that I can trust God with my whole life in a similar way that I trust my wife. And this incredible truth isn't just true for me. It's true for you. If Jesus rose from the grave, you're not just a bunch of cells and atoms. You're not just a bunch of chemistry and biology. You're not that. You're made in the image of God. And you are valuable. You're beautiful. You are loved to an infinite extent. I don't know if you've ever thought about that. This ring that I have on my finger is from my boo. And it shows that her and I love each other. It's my wedding ring. But the reason why this thing has any value, it's silver. The only reason why this thing has any value is because of the fact that people are willing to pay. For a precious metal like this, people are willing to pay. If there really is a God in heaven, what would things like silver and gold mean to him? Nothing. The Bible says he holds the entire universe in his hand. What would God and all the what would gold and all the money in the universe mean to God? Nothing. What's the price he paid for you? His own life. In God's economy, there is nothing more valuable than his own life. And he took that unfathomable price upon himself and paid it for you and for me in the same way that I paid for this ring. What does that mean? My ring, it might be worth $100, $200. How much are you worth? If God laid down his life, no matter what your friend said online or at school, or maybe what your family says about you, think about this. No matter what anybody says about you, no matter the failures that you may have had or the mistakes, if God paid that price for you, that means you are infinitely valuable and no one can take that away. Because it was God himself that paid that price. That is what is true based on all of this evidence. And more than that, more than just being valuable, you're incredibly loved. Because it is only an act of immeasurable love that would cause somebody to pay everything they had in order to save you and connect with you. As Paul the Apostle writes in Galatians 2:20, Jesus loved me and gave himself up for me. And that's true for you. Alistair McGrath, another guy from Oxford University, he once wrote that the most radical question that anyone can be asked is not how much their possessions cost, but whether they have found something of real value. That is, something that makes living worthwhile. Maybe some of you have thought about that question. What makes life worthwhile? Or perhaps my life isn't worthwhile. Jesus, the one that paid this infinite cost to show you how loved you are and how valuable you are, is something of real value. A value that is far more precious than any sort of success or career or money. Those things will come and they will go. But the value and love that God has placed on you will remain forever. Which leads me to my very last point, is that God can be personally experienced. Maybe some of you have experienced God yourself. I've talked to several of you that have experienced God recently, and I was just taken aback about how a life can be touched by God's own hand. And how somebody that feels like they are in the pits, whether it's addiction, or whether it's whatever you're struggling with, maybe it's a sense of brokenness or hurt, that God can touch that life and restore that life. I was telling somebody today that that same God who made you is the same God who can restore you. And as I stand here today, I'm not simply persuaded that belief in God is rational based on these evidences, but I'm convinced of the truth of Jesus because I've tested it and found it to be true. Some people will say, you know, like, the problem is with Christianity, you can't test nothing. In science, we can test things. And my professor used to say to those people that that's nonsense. That's absolute nonsense. Jesus claims tonight, his offer for you tonight, in this room, that if you take that step in trusting him as God, as your personal rescuer, that you will receive tonight forgiveness, peace, new life, and a new power. That's easily testable. Easily testable. And if you haven't, I would encourage you, and maybe you're saying, Zoe, I'm not ready for that. We're going to be talking about this stuff all weekend long. And if you are really serious, then talk to any one of these people in the back or even some of your friends that you came here with that do know Jesus and ask them. Ask them, what has Jesus done in your life? What difference has he made? And as I travel the globe and speak with people, literally millions of people around the globe for over 2,000 years have had their lives transformed beyond any recognition by Jesus himself. And you can talk to any one of these people because they're here because they love you and they want to invest in you. And you can ask them all of your questions. You know, Christians are obligated by God to be hospitable. So ask them to take you out to a nice restaurant because you have lots of questions about Jesus. And order, you know, a nice steak or a nice lobster and tell them you're really serious about your faith. And you have to show me hospitality because I'm interested in God. And you take them up on that and you ask your faith, you ask your questions. And they, I know because I've been chatting with them and they've been praying for you and talking about you guys nonstop. And they love you and are willing to help you and take them up on their offer for that steak that I've now obligated them to. Let me just tell you this one last story, and then we'll get into our time of question and answer. I have lots of friends in Asia, so in India and Hong Kong and in China and Japan and so on. And once when I was reading about China, I came across this story, and it's called Chinese Cruel Bread. And this story, it was crazy. So there was a ridiculous famine that went on in mainland China. This is some time ago. And in this famine, in this village, they were really struggling to find something to eat because obviously it's a famine. And as they're looking for something to eat, they find this clay. And this clay was really interesting and the people were really ingenious. They could take this clay, they could add water to it, knead it to like this dough, and then put it over the fire and bake it, and it would become like a loaf of bread. And it would have the same texture and different things, and you could eat it. And they had this loaf of bread from this type of clay. Now, here was the problem. It wasn't soon after that they discovered that this bread was devoid of any sort of nutrients. It had no carbohydrates. It had no vitamins, no minerals, none of those sorts of things. And so when they would eat this bread, even though their stomachs were full, they starved to death. The world will offer you all sorts of different breads to satisfy the hunger of your heart, to fill that emptiness. And you know there are a type of breads out there that are trying to do this. It can be various addictions like pornography that claim to satisfy whatever urges you may have. It can be things like friends that if I have enough friends, then I'll finally not feel alone. If I just have enough money, if I can just accomplish this thing and just get my parents' love and affection, if I can just do this, then really the hunger of my heart, it'll be finally satisfied. But it's been the experience of every single generation that hunger in your heart will not be so easily satisfied. What's on offer when we're talking about Jesus this weekend is Jesus who claims to be the bread of life. And it is this bread of life that is overflowing with the divine nutrients of heaven, of real satisfaction, of real life, of real joy and real peace. And that's what's on offer. And you can take of this bread anytime you want. You pray to Jesus to come into your life, test him in it, and see if he's true. That's my time, guys. Thank you so much for giving me a listen.
Thanks, man. Can we give Elijah another hand? Um,